You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jemma Gaudette. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. And today our panel includes Melissa Davlett, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spachek with the Idaho Statesman, and Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com. Hello, everybody, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday,
Hello.
Sam.
Hello.
Melissa, we'll start with you. The governor signed the abortion bill this week. Lots of reaction to this one. I think my inbox blew up after it happened. What happens now? What is it? What happens now?
Well, so you've discussed the abortion legislation on this show before, but just as a reminder, you know, this is a bill that would allow family members of the fetus, basically, to sue an abortion provider for abortions that occur after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And there was a huge push to convince Governor Little to veto this piece of legislation. On Tuesday, he went ahead and signed it, and he attached what's called a transmittal letter, which it basically tells lawmakers his thoughts about the legislation. The interesting thing about this letter is it almost sounds like a veto letter. This isn't the first time Governor Little has signed a piece of legislation while noting his major reservations about it. In this particular one, he makes it clear that, you know, he is a governor who is anti-abortion. He believes that Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey were incorrectly decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. But he has major concerns with this legislation's novel civil enforcement mechanism, which allows private citizens to sue. He says that he fears that it will be proven both unconstitutional and unwise. He worries that it will have unintended consequences for victims of sexual assault and incest, although there are exceptions in the legislation for those victims, because it requires a police report and because, you know, sometimes the wheels of law enforcement and justice turn very slowly. He's concerned that exception will be meaningless for many, as he put it. And so he asked lawmakers to come up with follow-up legislation to help fix those problems that he cited and that many opponents of this bill cited. As we near the end of the session, it doesn't look like that follow-up legislation is likely. You can bet, I'm not a betting woman, but if I were, this is going to end up in court. The Texas legislation that this was modeled on has been, the merits of it have not been decided by the court, just standing on whether or not people can sue over it. And so I imagine that this is going to be a nationwide discussion for several months to come.
And there were plenty of people opposed to this. I like I said, my email blew up. I'm sure a lot of reporters did, who are against it for various reasons. And even, as you said, the governor said this is probably unconstitutional and will end up in court. But we have a fund for that, don't we?
We do have a constitutional defense fund. I'll also note that as many people as were upset about this, the governor's office said that about 2-1, the comments that they received, and they received, you know, a few thousand comments on this, about 2-1 encouraged Governor Little to sign the legislation, not veto it.
Interesting. Interesting. And of course, in a election year, you know, his decision may have been other in a non-election year. We don't know.
Well, exactly. You have to think that the fact that it is an election year played into his decision on whether or not to veto it. And also the fact that this had widespread support among the supermajority Republican caucuses in both the House and the Senate. That isn't a guarantee that a veto could be overturned. But when it has that much widespread support, you have to think that that also goes into the calculation.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll look for a lawsuit on that. And we'll continue with you, Melissa, and the library budget, which apparently is holding up the legislature going home. Is that a fair assessment?
Among other things, you know, this happens every year. We're in the last scramble toward adjournment. There are always a couple bills that get caught up and get voted down. On Thursday, that was the budget for the Commission on Libraries. And so that the House voted that down yesterday, very narrowly, just by a few votes. So the Joint Budget Committee had to reconvene this morning to take care of that and a budget bill that the governor actually vetoed last night over concerns about restrictive language in that budget for information technology. So this library's budget takes out the new one that just passed JFAC, the Joint Finance Committee, this morning. It takes out $3.5 million in ARPA funds that would have paid for grants for technology projects across Idaho libraries. It also takes out about $300,000 in general funds, the state funds, for digital electronic books that would have gone to Idaho K through 12 public schools. The Joint Budget Committee wasn't excited about having to redo this budget. This had bipartisan opposition from some members because they weren't happy to see the removal of those local grants. From others, particularly Representative Ron Nate, who said that it didn't go far enough, that they should remove more money from the Commission for Libraries budget because of concerns about obscene materials ending up in children's hands. That's a debate that has come up in the legislature this year and led to, you know, multiple pieces of legislation that you've talked about on this show before. That new budget passed out of the Joint Finance Committee today. It has not yet hit the House floor. I have the House session on right now, and they're at ease. We, you know, there's a very real chance this could go down again today because there might be enough lawmakers who agree with Representative Nate that it doesn't go far enough, that it doesn't address the concerns about obscene material. And if that's the case, we're almost certainly going to see lawmakers here again next week as opposed to adjourning sine die today like they had hoped.
Exactly. And so if you're listening to us at 8 o'clock tonight, you may want to check and see what happened and whether they have gone home.
I'm in the same predicament. I'm taping Idaho Reports here in a few hours, and I don't anticipate that we're going to know what happens before our show airs at 8 o'clock tonight as well. So we'll find out together.
Okay. Don, the CEO of Micron was on Capitol Hill this week. Why was he there? And is Micron going to expand the Boise site? Do we know?
Yeah, so Micron CEO Sanjay Mehrotra appeared in front of a Senate panel on, what day was that? Tuesday? This week is, this feels like the fourth Friday this week.
Exactly.
On Tuesday, he was there along with the Intel CEO and a couple of other CEOs outside of the tech industry, pitching for support for a pair of bills in Congress that, if both passed, would provide fairly significant incentives for semiconductor makers like Intel and Micron to bring manufacturing back to U.S. soil. As it stands right now, most semiconductors aren't made here. Micron Technology was founded in Boise in the 1980s, and for a decent amount of time, it made all of its chips at the facility off of Federal Way in Southeast Boise. But now, for the most part, that facility, though large and sprawling, is actually for research and development on future generations of chips. And only 2% of all semiconductor memory chips, so these are the little tiny chips that go in your phones and your laptops and in, you know, fighter jets and
your cars,
washer and dryer, your cars that store information, only 2% of those chips are made domestically. They are made by Micron in Manassas, Virginia. And it's pretty fascinating because they're hoping that the federal government will sort of catch this moment where we have a major chip shortage around the world. That is, if you try to buy a car lately, you know it's not exactly easy. And the reason in large part is because they can't get the computer chips. Some car manufacturers are actually building the cars and putting everything in them but the computer chips, and then storing them out on a lot until they can get the chips to finish them up and ship them off. So it's a major concern. The other thing that came up during the hearing is rising geopolitical tension. Now, while chips are not made in Ukraine, a lot of semiconductor chips are made, I shouldn't say none, but not a material amount. Semiconductor chips are primarily made in Taiwan. Taiwan, of course, is contentious for the Chinese government, which they call it a Republic of China, Taiwan Republic of China. And the folks on Capitol Hill, the CEOs and legislators basically said, hey, if Russia can invade Ukraine, who knows if China could invade Taiwan. So they cite it as a national security risk to not have chips made here in America. So that's kind of the action on Capitol Hill. A couple things are happening here locally. One, Boise Dev, since November, Margaret Carmel and myself have been deep at work on trying to understand what Micron is doing about potential expansion. We have three sources who we cannot name because they are not authorized to speak on the record, who have told us that Boise is either the candidate or one of a number of candidates for a new fabrication facility. This would be a huge investment. Micron said, CEO Mehrotra said that it would be tens of billions of dollars for these fabrication plants. And our reporting indicates that Boise is a location for one of those plants. Micron has some fairly significant incentive to do it here. One, legislation passed in about 2008 that was designed to attract a French nuclear company to Idaho, helped Micron. Ultimately, the French nuclear company didn't come here, but the way the law was written, if a company spent a certain amount of money in capital expansion in the state in a five-year period from the time that the bill was signed, they could cap their property tax value forever. Micron's property tax value in Ada County is, and I don't have the number right in front of me, is capped at somewhere between $400 and $500 million. So if they go in and they spend $10 billion, or frankly, even $1 billion on a new fab plant, they aren't going to have to pay incremental property tax, which is a massive savings to the company on property tax. In addition, legislation was introduced in the House, passed both the House and the Senate this session, that is similar to legislation that happened last year in the Idaho legislature that handed out tax breaks for data center expansion, which, as we know, Meta and Facebook took, the same company, but Meta slash Facebook took advantage of in CUNA. Now, similar legislation that would allow for tax breaks on sales tax for an expansion of a semiconductor manufacturer has passed through the House and the Senate. I haven't checked today, but it's on Governor Little's desk. I would be exceedingly surprised if the governor didn't sign that. So you have this picture that's coming into view here. We know that Micron wants to expand in Boise. We know that Micron is on Capitol Hill asking for federal incentives to expand. We know that there's sales tax legislation that would benefit Micron. And we know that there's previously passed property tax legislation that would benefit Micron. The company, and I know you've got to get to a break, the last thing I'll say is the company says that they need the help of these governments and these tax breaks because there's a 45% price differential to overseas manufacturing versus domestic manufacturing, meaning it's about 45% cheaper to produce overseas. They say if governments want to protect supply chains and protect national security, they need the government's help to do these things. Your listeners can decide if that's the appropriate use of those tax dollars, and there's lots of opinions on that. That's what the company says. That's what's happening.
I'm looking at a wonderful BoiseDev.com story that says the taxable value of Micron's property is set at $400 million forever. In 2019, the company paid $4.75 million in property taxes. So $400 million is the cap on the taxable value. But as of this writing in this article, which I think is 2020, the actual value of the property was $1.86 billion. It's a bit of a difference.
Well, and this is a factor, frankly, in the rising rates of residential property taxes. Because Micron is paying less, and I'm not going to get into the whole property tax formula right now because it's real complicated. Because Micron is paying less, it means that there is has been for several years, both from Micron and other commercial property, there has been a shift in top property tax burden from commercial property to residential property. And so it is very much something that people have their eye on. But so far, the legislature has stood firm both on the exemption for Micron as well as the shift that occurred in like 2016, Melissa probably knows the date better than I do, that changed the calculation between commercial and residential property. So it's a big issue and there are lots of questions.
Melissa, one more thing before you have to go and work on your show. During all the action this week in the Idaho legislature, not everyone noticed that Ammon Bundy was back in court. What happened this time?
He was back in court on Wednesday. Our producer, Ruth Brown, covered this. He was accused of contempt of court stemming from prior his first trespassing incident. So this was during the special session in August 2020 when he refused to leave the Lincoln Auditorium at the State House. A jury convicted him of trespassing and resisting arrest. He was sentenced to 40 hours of community service. And late last year, he tried to claim in court that campaigning for public office, so his campaign as now an independent gubernatorial candidate, he said that should count as community service. The Ada County prosecutors did not agree. And so on April 7th, there's going to be an evidentiary hearing on those contempt accusations. This is separate from the early March conviction that he had for trespassing accusations also at the State House, this time from April 2021. And remember, too, he was arrested in early March for accusations of trespassing at St. Luke's in Meridian. Bundy on Wednesday represented himself once again, and we'll keep following this and all of the other charges that he's facing.
Very good. Well, thanks, Melissa. We know you got to run. Where can people catch your show tonight?
Idaho Reports airs at 8 p.m. Fridays on Idaho Public Television. You can also catch it online at idahoptv.org/Idaho Reports.
You got it. All right. We'll see you later. And Nate.
Thanks, Sam.
Nate, I'm going to let you talk now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It seems like every week we get some kind of update in the Chad and Lori Daybell case. And this week we got two, and we know EastIdahoNews.com has been following this very closely. Can you give us a very quick update of the charges against the pair for anyone who may not know?
Yes. Both Chad and Lori Daybell are charged with multiple counts of conspiracy to commit murder and first-degree murder for the deaths of 7-year-old JJ Vallow, 16-year-old Tylee Ryan, that's both Lori's kids, and Chad's first wife, Tammy Daybell. They were both indicted by a grand jury at the same time, and their cases have always been connected the cases have been connected since then.
And so that was one of the things that came up in court. A judge said that they have to be tried together because Chad tried to split the cases apart. How will that work? Because Lori Vallow Daybell is unfit to stand trial right now. So what happens to Chad?
You know, that is a really good question. The judge decided in his memo when he said that the cases are going to stay together, that it was efficient, economic, and it would avoid any possible inconsistent verdicts for the cases to stay together. He also went ahead and added that this should in no way be construed as a stay on the case pending the determination of Lori's competency. So we know that the judge is sort of planning on this all going forward in January 9th of 2023, but we really don't know if Lori is going to be competent, and we really don't know what that means either, because if she's not competent, the case isn't going to go forward.
Well, not if they're tied together. Definitely yeah. Not. That trial, assuming it happens in January, has been moved to Ada County. So, this is something that a lot of people are watching. And the second thing that happened This week, Chad Daybell's lawyer asked a judge to dismiss his case. Did that work?
Yeah. In this case, this was actually a really complicated hearing because it had to do with the grand jury, which is in itself private. It's something that happens out of the public eye. And Chad Daybell's attorney, John Pryor, was arguing about the selection of grand jurors, that it wasn't fair, that the things weren't impartial. They were arguing about how the grand jury proceedings were recorded, and a whole bunch of points that were hard to contextualize because we have never seen the grand jury and don't know a lot about it. And to compound matters, the judge decided that before he makes a decision, he wants both of them to submit sealed briefs for him to decide. And when he makes his decision, that's going to be sealed too. So there's not a good chance, obviously, that this indictment is going to be dismissed. I think it's fairly clear that this is going to go forward. But if for some reason it was dismissed, we wouldn't know why, because it would be under seal.
Okay. And I know for folks who haven't been following as closely as you have, that EastIdahoNews.com does have a timeline and a whole lot more explanation of the case and what's going on. So it sounds like we've got a couple more things coming up and then a possible trial in January to watch for. All right. Rachel, hi.
Hi. Thanks for noticing me.
Yeah, I know, right? You are on the show today. Isn't that great? Okay. So the FBI is investigating the Caldwell Police Department. What do we know?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, these investigations are obviously difficult to figure out, you know, because the FBI won't tell us anything because it's an ongoing investigation and neither will the city. But the city did say last week, they did confirm that the FBI was investigating certain officers in the Caldwell Police Department. And I don't know if any listeners are on Canyon County Twitter, but I am. And there was a lot of speculation about Police Chief Frank Wyant and, you know, whether he was going to be fired or was in the process of being terminated. And the city confirmed that he is not the subject of the investigation and is still employed. And so, yeah, that's basically what we know so far. You know, the city council had an executive session last week, and, you know, no one could tell me what was happened in the executive session. And so, you know, we're just looking to see what's going on. You know, there's a lot of speculation going around about what this could be about. And yeah, so just keep your eye out for any, you know, this is a developing situation. But yeah, the thing to know is that the FBI is investigating a couple Caldwell police officers.
And we don't know who and we don't know why, but we do know it's not the chief.
Yes.
All right. Don, tell us this strange and twisted story of a shipping container park in Garden City and the man behind it. And by twisted, I mean this has been going on for a while and has taken all kinds of turns.
Yeah, Jason Jones and his wife, Kristen, moved to Garden City. Actually, they moved to Boise, but they moved to the area in 2018. They bought some land in Garden City, which, as folks know, is really close to downtown Boise and has really developed up in recent years. And they wanted to build a shipping container park, basically using shipping containers to create a multi-story development for craft breweries, artists, food vendors, living spaces, all sorts of things. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel reported on this week and found that it can move forward. But you might ask, well, if he proposed it in 2019, why are we talking about this in 2022? But what happened is, according to the Idaho Statesman at the time, the city of Garden City, denied the project. The catch is he had applied for it at the end of 2019, and in February of the next year, the city passed a ban on containers from the city, but that was after he'd already applied. So he went to court and asked for what's called judicial review, which essentially gets a judge involved and says, hey, did the city do the right thing here? We don't think they did. And after several years, the judge has ruled and said, yeah, no, you were grandfathered in and you can move forward. So now, after several years, this project will start to move forward on 33rd Street near the Garden City 34th Street Market. So Talaya is down there, not too far from the riverside, the Whitewater Park. So we're going to start to see this kind of inch along here pretty soon. Jason Jones tells us that one of the problems is it's going to cost a lot more because, as folks know, construction costs continue to increase really month over month and almost day after day. And so some frustration there with the delay, but ultimately you'll see this project come to light most likely here soon.
Wow. Okay. Amazing story. And Rachel, you had a great story about the rising cost of renting a home. You profiled Gail Salzman. What's her story?
Yeah, so this story was another piece in a series, a collection of pieces we're doing at The Statesman called Affording Boise, about our affordable housing crisis here. Gail's story is one that, we've heard from a lot of folks in the area, but she's mostly on a fixed income. She's elderly, so she has Social Security. This is seniors and also people on disability with that fixed income. And Gail is 79. She lives in Boise, and her rent is going up $700 soon. And, I talked to a couple local experts, and, it's hard on all of us to, try to respond to these increases in rent in the Treasure Valley market. But it's especially difficult for people who their income is fixed, and, it doesn't respond to the rise in prices, whereas, some of us could go talk to our bosses and ask for a raise, or, our bosses know that rent is getting higher here. And these people just don't have that ability. And so, they are one of the victims of this affordable housing crisis. And, there's also not a lot of inventory, so Gail can't really move anywhere. She's thought about maybe moving into assisted living. That's a move. She's very independent, but that's a move she's had to contemplate because she can't afford her apartment. And so she's just wondering what to do, basically. If anyone is compelled listening to this, there is a GoFundMe for her in the story at idahostatesman.com. And part of what we're doing with this series is profiling individuals, but, talking about their issues as they relate to others struggling with this, because, she's not obviously the only person on fixed income who has to respond to a rising rent. So, yeah, it's a struggle for a lot of people, and particularly on fixed income.
Well, yeah, and it seems like every legislative session, lawmakers give a little boost to the circuit breaker program, and that helps seniors who own their homes to help stay in, as property taxes and other costs go up. But there's really not much help for seniors who on a fixed income who rent.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of what I've wanted to do with this series is, in general, there's not a lot of legislation that helps renters that we've seen recently. Maybe we've seen some efforts, but they haven't been, approved. There are renters out there on fixed incomes, lots of renters in Boise, not a lot of places to rent. And, that's leading to the rise in prices.
Gotcha. And so I'm sure we can find the rest of your series at the Idaho Statesman, and and we'll be watching for more.
Yeah. And just to, do a little plug at noon on Thursday next week, I have a panel with a couple people that I'm hosting, and we're going to be talking about what you know, the solutions are, if there are any solutions for our affordable housing crisis. So that'll be on the statesman.com too.
Nice. All right. Nate, I wanted to ask you about this story. EastIdahoNews.com sued Jefferson County after it denied your public records case about a school shooting. So give us a quick idea of the case. Why did you sue, and what did the judge say?
Sure. Last May, we had a school shooting. Obviously, that doesn't happen very often in Idaho, and it's a pretty traumatic event for our communities. A 13-year-old girl, she brought a gun to school. She shot two students and a custodian. And we got a little bit of information that day from prosecutors and a little bit more information the next day, and then everything just went silent. We didn't hear another thing about the case. Everything was sealed. No officials would talk about it. And we thought, you know what? This was a pretty big event for Eastern Idaho. This was a pretty traumatic event for Eastern Idaho. We need to find out at least a little bit more here. Specifically, we wanted to find out the sequence of events, what law enforcement found. We wanted to know the outcome of the case because we don't know that. We want to know what charges were filed, whether it was a conviction, and if there was a sentence. And so we went ahead and we sued Jefferson County. We wanted access to the investigative report from the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office and 911 calls. And we had requested both of those prior to this with a records request from the Sheriff's Department. And the prosecutor denied that records request. And he said, well, essentially, he thought that these were not public records because they had been used in court. And because they'd been used in court, they constituted court records. And because they were juvenile court records, they were sealed to the public. Ultimately, the judge agreed with us that they were not, in fact, court records, that they are public records from the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. And he decided that we could have access to them, provided that we redact pretty much the names of everyone involved except for law enforcement. That was fine with us. One of the things we don't want to do here is ruin the life of this 13-year-old girl. She's already majorly harmed her own life with the school shooting, and we certainly don't want to continue to hurt her. And there is that opportunity with journalism is to hurt her even though she's a suspect in a crime.
Wow. And do you have those records yet?
We don't yet. There's actually quite a few of them. It sounded like there was about 30 hours of 911 calls and several reams of documents. And they're in the process of redacting them now. We're in the process of negotiating price with them. They'd like to charge us about $2,000 for the documents.
And you wrote a whole sort of expose about why you were requesting these public records and why you felt the public needed to know this part of the case. And I think it's, as you said, there's a fine line there in journalism to help the public understand what has happened and to protect the people who have been harmed.
It's true. And, you know, it was interesting because when we posted that explanation, there was a very strong divide we saw on social media. There was a lot of people, and this actually surprised us, that came out and said, don't request these records. Don't dig into this girl's life anymore. And then there was almost equally as many people saying, no, we need to know more about this event. We deserve to know more about this event. It was really very surprising to us to see the divide in the community over whether we should continue to dig.
Wow. All right. right. So it sounds like eventually you'll have those records and you'll be putting out more information.
Yeah, we're hoping within the next month or so.
Got it. Rachel, let's try a lightning round. I'll name the topic and you give us a very quick update, starting with the City of Eagle and a Foothills shooting range. Go.
Yes. So this has been in the works. It's related to the City of Eagle, Foothills. Some of them up there is BLM land that was annexed into the city. And the city wanted to, you know, kind of make a cohesive user park for people. But the latest is that the Spring Valley, one of the Spring Valley developers wants to donate some land to the city to put in a shooting sports park. So that would be, you know, places where people can do archery and shoot all kinds of guns. But some neighbors are not into that because they live within 1,700 feet of this proposed shooting range. And, you know, they don't want to hear gunfire consistently throughout the day. So that's what's happening. Eagle is still going through the process. You know, they have to do a bunch of studies, a sound, traffic, environmental studies. So I'll keep following that. But that's basically what's been going on in Eagle.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sam, so Rachel's reporting and our Gretchen Marston's looked at this, and it led me down this rabbit hole, which found another story about Spring Valley, which is that they have quietly moved forward with this idea to ask for up to $600 million in bonding, or a total of almost $1 billion with interest to be paid over 30 years. And what's fascinating here is that the only people who can vote on that, we think, are the owners of the land, the developers. And it's a big future tax bill for people who live in the Spring Valley area. So lots going on up there.
Okay, that's a $1 billion rabbit hole you fell into there.
It is based on the gun range.
Casually.
Okay.
Yeah, I was like, oh, we need to update our project tracker. I read Rachel's story and I was like, oh, I need to update the project tracker. And I was like, wait, what?
Okay, there you go. Okay, Don, lightning round continues. Airlines coming to Boise. What's the new list?
We got two of them. We've got the bright yellow highlighters that are also called Spirit Airline planes. If you've seen these, they're bright yellow with the word Spirit on them. They are a very low-cost airline. They will charge you for just about everything on top of your ticket fee. They're going to launch flights to Las Vegas this summer. You also have Avelo Airlines, which is kind of a new upstart. They plan to fly between Boise and Hollywood Burbank, which will give a fifth destination in Southern California between San Diego, Palm Springs, LAX, John Wayne, and now Hollywood. So if you want to fly between here and SoCal, you're going to have lots of options. And as we all know, there are more and more people that fly between here and SoCal on a daily basis.
Wow. All right, Nate, a quick update in the case against Bingham County Sheriff Craig Rowland. Go.
Well, this week, the Idaho Attorney General's office filed a motion to get his attorney, Justin Olison, off the case because he serves as the part-time Custer County prosecuting attorney. The Attorney General's office essentially said, you have a duty to the state, and that's a conflict of interest, and so you can't defend someone to the state. Olison, which is in his typical fashion, says, no, I have permission from the state and Custer County. I have permission from my client. And the real reason you're doing this is just because you're scared of me.
And we have reported with you or have had EastIdahoNews.com on to talk about the case against the sheriff, which includes a troop of girls knocking on his door to leave a thank you note. And then allegedly he came out with a gun. So it's a crazy case. And I know you guys will keep following it. Okay, Don, I can buy a motel in Garden Valley. Go.
Yes, you can. This is the Garden Valley Motel, named very simply. It is on the Banks to Lowen Road, and it's for sale. It's 12 key, but they say 12 key, so 12 room motel and some additional land. My wife and I are big fans of these cheesy bio motel and fix them up shows. And so I think I have a latent dream of getting to do this. As I told our readers on Facebook, I will not be doing this. And some readers might curse that. Some might wish that I would go away. But you can, and there's more in the story up at BoiseDev.com right now. And that's a pretty hefty price tag for a motel in Garden Valley, but an interesting opportunity for the right person.
Well, it was sure a pretty picture that you had on the BoiseDev.com article.
Yeah.
And we'll stick with you, Don. So two words, pumpkin curry in the Ram Plaza in Boise.
Yeah, BoiseDev.com's Anna Daly reported on this. This is the old Pat's Thai location near the Ram. And it's open. It opened this week. It's a new Thai restaurant. And somebody pointed out to me they believe this is the first place in Boise that you can get tea leaf salad. Really close to downtown, so a place to pop over for lunch if you're looking at either Thai or Burmese food. And so I'm excited to go check it out. It's called Nam Thai and Burmese Cuisine, and open on Wednesday.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, we've only got a couple minutes left. So Nate, you wrote a story on bullying at the American Falls School District and how they allegedly ignored a gun threat. I know this is a very long, very complicated story, and you have a great article on East Idaho News, but give me just the bare bones.
The bare bones is that we had a woman that we've worked with for several months now to get a story about how her children were essentially scared to go to school because there were several students there who were continually making threats, and over a period of 2 years, this woman tried with the school district to get them to do something, and they never did. And the last straw for her was when right after the Rigby school shooting, one of these students came and said, you know, I'm going to shoot up the school. I mean, it was terrifying for these kids. And we highlighted essentially this whole, everything this woman and her family has gone through.
Gotcha. And a lot of interesting parts to this story, because she has done everything she can or tried to do, even going to the Board of Education. So we highly recommend checking that out. It's on eastidahonews.com. And guess what, Reporter Roundtable? It is that time again to say goodbye. So I want to say thanks to all of you. Special thanks to Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, and Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com. Thank you all so much for coming on the show today.
Happy weekend.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
All right, and thank you for joining us. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. If you have a question or a comment or an idea for the show, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudet, who will be back next week. Have a great weekend.